Well, our next speaker, Thomas Osborne, will be doing this time slot today and tomorrow. We're very blessed that he is here today. As you can see from the first slide, he is the Chief Medical Officer of Microsoft Federal. And I can't claim to understand what that means. Maybe Tom will explain it. But more importantly, he's a clinical professor at Stanford's Artificial Intelligence and Medicine program. And just from his Stanford site, his bio, he is board certified in diagnostic imaging and neuroradiology. He's devoted his professional career to accelerating the advancement of the intersection of healthcare technology. He is driven to solve challenges for broad positive impact and shared success. His academic publications cover diverse topics like cancer, infectious disease, neurological disorders, surgery, climate health, falls, elder care, repurposing of drugs. Got his MD degree from Dartmouth, which is like legendary in terms of its history of artificial intelligence. In the origins there, and he did his clinical residency and fellowship at the Harvard Hospital Systems, and he's been an advisor and mentor to other healthcare leaders for most of his career, and we are so honored that Tom is speaking with us today. So it's all yours, Tom.
All right. Thanks so much. Great to be here. Appreciate it. A little bit taller on here. Okay. So what a fantastic time that we're living in. I mean, we've heard some early talks today about the profound impact that we could have with these tools. And I'm happy to talk about some of them. Some of them you've heard about before. Some of them you may not have heard about before because they're just getting started. I'm sort of at a unique place being at Microsoft and also Stanford. So I'm sort of splitting the difference between an industry that's doing a lot of work in advanced technologies, specifically AI, and also Stanford that's doing a lot of implementation of those tools. So it's interesting. I teach at Stanford, and I wasn't sure I was going to talk about this, but I'll do it anyways. And I teach the neurosurgery residents, and I was asking them, hey, what do you want to learn about? And I was thinking, you know, obviously they want to learn about, you know, medicine and neuro and anatomy and physiology. And I was just thinking that's what they wanted to learn about. And they're like, no, we want to learn about entrepreneurship. We want to learn about the latest technologies because they have ideas that now are possible to be deployed by a single person because we have these tools that have really democratized the ability for people to create new solutions without having a whole industry behind them. You know, so I think this is such a dramatic time, not only with the technology, but how empowering the technologies are. And with that, I suspect, this is a little prediction I'm going to put out there just to get people a little controversial maybe. I suspect, and I believe that in the next 2 to 3 years, there'll be a one-person company that's worth $1 billion. This will happen, maybe in medicine. And why it will happen is because these tools that we have are going to be empowering, because the tools that we have are going to be able to outsource a lot of the overhead that you would usually have to build the company. So if you're entrepreneurial, this is a great time to be working in this space. And in particular, medicine is at a turning point. It's an inflection point. We heard about this a little bit earlier today, but the way I think about it, there's no shortage of problems to solve in healthcare. You know, we live this every day. But if you really solidify it into the big, gnarly problems, there's probably three big problems. Growing cost. $5 trillion a year is spent in the U.S. on healthcare, 20% of our GDP. Huge cost. Patients, complexity of care, accelerating. We have a growing older population also contributing to that. And lastly, we don't have enough physicians. We heard about nearly 200,000 physician shortage happening. But that's in the U.S. across the globe, it's in the millions. So the problems in the US are not unique. These things are happening everywhere. All right, let's get started on the talk. All right, as I said, most exciting time in history, also a lot of challenges. Today, we're going to talk about a couple things, and I have some questions for you to think about as I go through these slides. A couple of things. What is an AI agent, and what is agentic AI? Some people use them synonymously. They're not. They're related. One actually kind of leads to the other. So we're going to talk about that a little bit. I'll sort of set that up so we can logically go into that space that's kind of new and emerging. So why do these things matter? Why are we going to even talk about these things? I'll dig into that. And what does this all mean for us and what's coming, what's going to come around the corner? All right. So any AI talk, you obviously want to talk about responsible and ethical AI. Not enough time to dig into that, but I just wanted to give two sides of the same coin here. At one level, we need to do this thoughtfully and responsibly, and the best way to do that is, in my opinion, is to get as many people educated about this space as possible and bring as many relevant people to the table. People in technology are not going to be able to do this successfully by themselves. People in medicine, for example, are also not going to be able to successfully do that by themselves. It's the collaboration, it's the intersection, it's the shared insights. The challenges that we have, though, is all of us speak different languages, perhaps all English, but different languages within that. IT has its own vernacular, healthcare, even domains of healthcare, as we all know. And then you have the administrative side, the financial side. So we need translators at that intersection, and it could be us. The translators are going to be key to success in the future and now. The other side, so doing it responsibly and ethically is very important. So we do all that because there's risk, right? Any powerful tool can be used for good or bad, even unintentionally. But there's also a risk that not many people are talking about that I think is super important for us to keep in the back of our mind at the very least. There's a risk of not using these tools. When you have a powerful platform, a whole suite of tools, and I'm talking about AI is not just one solution, obviously, it's many different types of tools. When you have this toolbox that can radically transform people's lives, transform illness to wellness, and we overregulate it to the point, for safety's sake, that it's not being used, then we're potentially causing tremendous harm because we're not being able to deploy the solutions that can radically improve people's lives. So there's risks of not doing it. And there's also a major risk of not being at the table. You think about like nuclear proliferation. The countries that are at the table talking about that are the ones that are in the game. I suspect that's going to be the same for any technology, including AI. If we're not using the tools, if we're not developing the tools, if we're not part of the discussion, if we're not educated about it, then we may not be at the table to talk about how they're used ethically. So there's dangers of using these tools. We need to be responsible. There's also dangers of not using the tools. Moving on. All right, AI is powerful, but it's not magic. A lot of people talk about AI, just throw it on there. It's going to solve a problem. Nope. It's a tool, in my opinion, and it's not a solution typically by itself. And it is used, and the different types of AI are used for specific use cases. And if you can see in this picture, it's probably not the best resolution. And if you're someone like me who likes to spend some time in the shop, you know that the hammer is very powerful, but it's not always the right tool for everything. And there's a screw and not a nail there, and you can see the wood is split. So blindly using a tool to solve every problem is not the way to go. And in fact, I would also argue on this same idea is success with AI deployment. The number one idea behind success in deployment, I've done a lot of this, is solving problems that people want addressed. And that's sort of inverse. I mean, a lot of people say, hey, I got this tool, this tech, how can we use it? How can we deploy this new LLM or this new shiny object? I think that's okay to think about, but the most success will be when you flip that around and you start with a problem. Start with the problem, and then when you think you know the problem, you might just be getting started, and you go deeper and you go deeper. You talk to all the key stakeholders, you figure out all the angles, and then it's the problem, and then it's the people, it's the process, and the data, and then the technology comes last. That's been the formula for success for me. I've tried it different ways. That's really a profound way to go about doing things, especially in healthcare, and bringing all the right people to the table, super important. All right, so we're gonna talk about AI agents and agentic AI. And so this is really going to be a talk about increasing technological complexity. And in doing so, the intent is that increased technological complexity is going to decrease the complexity of care delivery. So kind of a flip. And in fact, on that note, I think at a high level, we're at such an interesting point in time that these tools that we're just trying to figure out at this point are, this is the dumbest they'll ever be. So that's important to think about. And it's also important to think about that these tools in general, that, you know, technology has sort of like pulled us away a bit from our patients and interacting with others. When we have these tools that offload all the burden, all the drudgery, all the nonsense, that it might actually help us to be more human, where we can do things that are more about how we're built, more social, more interactive, because we don't have to do those things that nobody wants to do, and it's not really how we're programmed. All right, some relevant background. I know many of you know this already, but I'm just gonna outline this to set things up. So in the beginning, there's machine learning. Actually, there's expert systems. And then there's machine learning. And that was, you know, 50s. And then towards the 80s, we started to advance some of that machine learning. And then we got into deep learning. And there was AlexNet. And that's about when I got into it, about 13, 14 years ago. And we got these machine learning tools that were really powerful. And many of the things that they could do was analyze data in a more profound way. And so a lot of the things that I've done was predictive analytics in the past. So you look at the past data, you look at the trends, and you can predict the future. Very profound in healthcare. If you can predict what's going to happen before it does, then you can intervene before you have crisis. Then, like November 2022, this other tool came out, which is actually a branch of deep learning and the LLMs. So, and that actually, Google came out with that, with the transformer model, but they kind of put it on the side. But, you know, OpenAI said that's a cool tool. They developed these LLMs. ChatGPT came out. And I thought, cool, another tool. I was naive. I didn't realize it was going to explode. And here we are. So I initially thought, okay, well, maybe we can use that instead of NLP and transform unstructured data into structured data. So that's where I was focused. But I had no idea about the tidal wave that was coming. But anyways, that's what it was. So LLMs led to generative AI, and basically with generative AI, you can transform existing data into new content. So those are kind of the big levels. Now we got a whole nother category that's coming out of that. See the shadowy figure in the corner there? That is a representation of an agent. And specifically, we got AI agents. So what on earth are we talking about here? So there's a lot of different definitions about what AI agents are. And so I'm a kind of a simpleton about this. AI-based solutions that automate narrow tasks. AI agents that automate narrow tasks. So that definition's a little bit broad, and it actually was coined in 1998. So this idea has been around for a long time, but it only really got traction about the time ChatGPT came out, because the LLM added some reasoning, added some intelligence to these systems, and they became more powerful. But the idea's been around for a while. And so with that definition, we've actually been using AI agents for a while, and so we'll talk about some of that stuff. Here's a couple of those articles I talked about. This one is from 98 that talked about AI agents. I think this is the first one that I found was talking about it. So it's been around for a while. And then this one here that just came out in a preprint outlines some of the ideas that are going to lead to agentic AI. And, you know, there's kind of some controversy about exactly what it is, but I like this one a lot. It provides a good framework, and the framework is going to help us think about things and move forward. So I'm going to get into this a little bit deeper. Wow, we got someone online here. Someone's contributing to the talk. It'll be a team effort. So we're going to talk about this thermostat analogy. So, okay, we got AI agents, and I don't know how to turn off that speaker. We got AI agents. What's that? Oh my gosh, you got to be careful how you unleash these things. I didn't realize it was going to be that automated. Thanks for taking care of that. That was the supervised machine learning, supervising us. Okay, so yeah, AI agents. This is going to be an analogy just to sort of give a pictorial view of what we're talking about. And so the pre-LLM AI agent was basically a simple automated tool, just like your thermostat in your house. You know, it simply checks the temperature up and down, air conditioning or heater goes on and off. So that's the sort of pre-LLM idea. Then the post-LLM era, it's weird that we're talking about pre and post in just a couple of years, but that's what we're talking about. Then you add another level of intelligence onto that system. So now you have a smarter system that controls a simple task. Now we have a lot of different things coming together, and that's where we're going to be talking about agentic AI. So you have all these different tools and technologies, different types of intelligence coming together to make your thermostat super smart. You've got data from the weather system, you've got data from your external sensors, you've got heat, you got UV, you got all these different intelligence that's super optimizing this tool. And it has memory, and it has reasoning, and it has learning. So we go from a simple, limited task to one that's much more complex that can do more things. All right, so we're still talking together. The agent will not give up. So there's a lot of these different AI agents by this definition, and some of them, like we said, we were talking about before. I'm a radiologist, so one of the early things that we used was computer-aided detection with mammography. That was very early on. That was a couple decades ago, actually. But clinical decision support, prioritization about who's going to get care first or who should get delayed care based on some elements, prediction, call center has different things. So, in fact, when we use these tools, it's not just in the delivery of care. We can also offload some of the burden with call centers. And so we have chatbots. Some of them are smarter than others. But the more intelligent they get, the better they are and the more good that they can do. So these are really being used. There's a cautionary tale in all of this, and I'm going to throw out one of them. Here's a paper I wrote with some colleagues a little while ago. And we were doing some work with supervised machine learning, and we were trying to help radiologists with clinical decision support to identify intracranial hemorrhage. Now, intracranial hemorrhage can be subtle sometimes, and you don't want to miss it. Obviously, big complications that can happen. And so we're using clinical decision support as a flag, as an alert, saying, hey, radiologists, I know you're done reading this, but did you notice? Did you want to look again? Because I think there's hemorrhage in the corner here. So that actually seems pretty cool, right? Having someone else help out. And that actually was quite profound, but it wasn't always right. Accuracy did go up, but as a side effect, we found that the radiologists were going much slower. So it's important to think about all the different angles when you're deploying these tools, because we can cause harm with good intent. In this case, the harm was the fact that there was decreased throughput. There was delays overall because radiologists were spending more time because they were done, but someone else was saying, hey, you missed something, and then they got to look again and look again, and that took more time. However, there's been other things that's been really demonstrably good, even with the time. So just sort of sectioning out different areas, doing volume averaging, measuring things more accurately. AI is very good at that. Actually, this other example here with AJNR, we've done a lot of work. I had done a lot of work with stroke, and using these tools to see where the penumbra is, and I can talk about that, basically where area of tissue at risk is so you can better stratify who can get TPA or advanced stroke lysis. That can all be visualized with these advanced tools. Very powerful. But if you talk to the stroke guys who are making the decision for TPA or for triage, what they loved the most was the fact that this was on their phone. And so at 3 a.m. when they get the call for the stroke, they could just look on their phone. So it was the UI in this case, which was actually more powerful in some ways than actually AI. So AI plus UI is more powerful. So it's not just AI in isolation. In fact, sometimes the UI is better. All right, so prediction models. This is sort of my jam. And I put some of these tools in here. So early on, I did a project with DeepMind, which at that time then became Google DeepMind. And we were trying to see if it was possible if historical data could then predict future outcomes. And one of the things we looked at was acute kidney injury, which is a really bad disease, obviously, and you want to catch it earlier, and usually you don't catch it until it's too late. And we found that we could predict who is going to get acute kidney injury reliably 2 days before it happened, which would give somebody ample time to say, hey, maybe the antibiotics should be adjusted, maybe you need some fluids, maybe some other problem. And so that was pretty profound, and we used the same ideas to predict overall mortality. We did this now in-house when I was at the VA. Overall mortality, so we could better triage patients for extended care or, you know, hospice care. We also looked at pre-surgical planning to see who was going to have a bad outcome after surgery, and we could predict likely who was going to have a bad outcome. We also were looking at COVID. Oh, now we got some serious feedback. Bad AI. So we also looked at COVID, and we could predict who was going to get a long admission, who was going to have an ICU stay, who's going to get intubated, and who's going to die. This is very early in COVID, but we had these predictive tools that could then help us triage a disease we didn't understand very well. We've used this for many different things, and I could go into all the different things. We've used it for cancer. We've used it for a variety of different tools. Other things didn't work. Actually, see it not unpublished here. It didn't work very well for some disorders like CHF, but it did work very well for others. So, okay, we're going to move on here. So this is, I think, a very, very interesting article. I unfortunately wasn't part of this, but my colleagues were. So there's been a lot of studies coming out about how foundational language models can do better than humans on standardized testing. In a particular, like entrance exam or certification exams, multiple choice tests. And that's interesting, they're getting better. But I think a legitimate argument against that was like, hey, that's not real life. Like we don't have, you know, 3 options to choose from, 4 options to choose from, A, B, C, D, when we're taking care of patients. So these folks got together and they said, why don't we make this a real life challenge for the AI? And we're gonna test humans, and we're gonna test AIs, and we're gonna test this other method that I'm gonna talk about. And so what they did is they took about a little more than 300 New England Journal of Medicine cases, some difficult cases, and they split them up. They took the content, but they split it up. And so they split it up in such a way where the people who were trying to solve these cases, whether it's AI, call it people, whether it's AI or clinicians, they would first see a clinical diagnosis like a HPI, a history of present illness, and then they could ask it questions and then to get more feedback. And then they could order tests and they could get more feedback. And so it was like a call and receive kind of a scenario. And so that's a whole new method. And so they called that the SD bench. So that was the first thing. And so the sequential diagnosis bench as a benchmarker, just to make it fair. Then they did the testing. And the foundational models just out of the box, whether it's Grok or Llama or GPT, they all did better than the humans, again. But what did demonstrably better than either one of them is when you had multiple agents working together. And so this idea of multi-agent orchestration. So it was just a sort of simple proof of concept, and they didn't even like train or tune or ground these other agents, these other models significantly. They just said, take on the persona of an agent that has a hypothesis about what's going on. Another one was like to test it, you know, to challenge that. Another one was like, you know, we're going to be stewards, good stewards about the best testing. And another was to make sure we went through everything and we didn't miss something. So we had all these different agents who were just prompted to take on a different identity, and all of them were working together. And that multi-agent scenario was then orchestrated by an overarching layer. So you had all these agents doing different tasks, and then you had another agent that orchestrated them all. So that's a multi-agent orchestrator. And so when we get into this, now we're talking about agentic AI. That agentic AI solution, just out of the box, was 4 times better than the physicians, and it came to the right diagnosis at a lower cost by ordering less tests and more appropriate tests. So that, I believe, that methodology is really going to change everything. Quite profound. All right, moving on. So this is one that I am involved with, and we have a preprint that I didn't put on here about it, but at Stanford, we took the same idea. So different agents can do different things. And so you can have an agent that can do really good at collecting data, another agent that's really good at organizing data, another agent that's good at analyzing different types of data, another agent's good at presenting data. All these different agents can have different roles and tasks that they can specialize in. And if you think about Tumor Board, if you guys been to Tumor Board, I'm sure some of you have, Tumor Board's like a multi-specialty group. You have all these different people coming together to solve a problem for a single patient, someone who's got complex type of cancer. And so you got people from oncology, radiation oncology, radiology, surgery, surgical oncology, all these different people coming together to try to bring the best solution possible for this patient in front of them. And the data is all over the place. You got lab, you got path, you got radiology. And so it's a scavenger hunt for people and for the things. And none of this is billable. And at a place like Stanford, it happens like 4,000 times a year. And so it's a lot of time and effort, but also it's a distraction because you have limited time as a physician and teams. And wouldn't it be better to spend that time on figuring out the best care for that patient instead of going on the scavenger hunt to get all that material that you need to then answer the question? And so we said, hey, why don't agents do this? And so, in fact, we did. And so we have agents that can do all those different things and automate it. What's particularly interesting for me and profound is this high level of expert care for patients in cancer only happens in academic centers, and not even all of them. And so the rest of the country, living in rural communities or a couple miles from an academic center, they're getting a different level of care just based on where they were born or where they live. And having these tools that can do this automatically has a profound opportunity to democratize the levels of care and how we perform. So what does that look like? Just to give you some topology, because I'm a visual person, and I think maybe some of you guys are too. So in this case, on this picture here, you have a database in your hospital, and multiple different databases, maybe they're cloud, maybe they're not, and you know, your EHR, you got your PACS, you got your RIS. And so you can have an agent that will take the history, the radiology, the staging, you got all these different agents. And that's internally. And you might have some agents that are also taking data externally. Like you might have a clinical guidelines agent, someone, you know, some agent that goes into the literature and see what's the best of care, what's the best of breed, what's the consensus guidelines. And you might even have an agent that dives into clinical trials and what's available with research.gov. And so you got these agents internally and externally that's pulling all this stuff together, and maybe even some custom agents. Then you have an overarching layer, which is this agent that coordinates all that stuff. And all that gets presented through a UI, so all the people on this tumor board team can have the right information for the right patient at the right time, so then they can spend their time coming up to the best conclusion. This architecture can be, you can rinse and repeat this for all the different challenges that we have that require multimodal analysis or data coming from many different places, which is, quite frankly, one of the biggest challenges, in my opinion, in healthcare. One of the biggest challenges in healthcare is we have the privilege of having all these different specialists, but many of them don't talk well with each other just because of the structure that we live in. And so these types of tools, quite profound. Now, that's good for clinical care, but like for those of us who have been on the administrative side of healthcare, you know well that there are silos everywhere. I mean, EMS, have they cleaned the room yet so the ED can admit the patient because the room's not available yet and we got to go and divert because it's not available and we don't know if the room's ready or the nurse is there? Most healthcare systems have poor insight about what's going on real time, let alone over time, to understand how to do real time process and quality improvement. So having these types of tools could be very, very powerful. And by the way, they're open source through Microsoft. Little plug. So anyways, a couple of conclusions in the interest of time here. AI agents, they've been automating tasks today and in the recent past. And so now we have this agentic AI, which is possible through the orchestration of many different agents. And so multidisciplinary groups and people coming together is where we're all powerful. One of the greatest parts of our country is diversity, tools, technologies, people. And these types of tools are going to allow us to empower that with greater fidelity. Thank you very much. Any questions? Osborne. Dr. Osborne. Yeah.
Thank you so much for the presentation.
Sure.
The question in my mind is what to do in 15% of erroneous diagnosis. So 85% there was correct diagnosis in the cases for neurodevelopism. What happens in 15% of wrong diagnosis? Who needs that? How do you go back and troubleshoot? How do you, like, when I make a wrong diagnosis, the patient comes back week and I'm able to figure out if the treatment type plan didn't work, patient symptoms didn't improve.
Yeah.
In this case, AI, whose responsibility to handle the erroneous diagnosis?
That's a great question. So I think we're referring, I'll just go back to get us all literally on the same page. So I think we're talking about this study.
Yes.
Okay, perfect. So what we saw in this study was basically what we do in healthcare is we do sequential diagnoses. You sort of have a hypothesis, and then you have a differential diagnosis. And then you order some tests, and you do some exams, and that differential gets smaller. And then you do some more tests, and the differential goes smaller. And hopefully that narrows down to the right answer. When we had just clinicians do this, the accuracy was 20% from these very difficult cases. 20% of these six physicians that tried to go through these very, very difficult, I mean, by definition, this is like New England Journal of Medicine's probably is trying to stump people with these really difficult questions because that's a fun exercise. So only 20% of the physicians got the answer right. The AI got it right 80% of the time. So do you want 20% or 80%? So that's a question. Now, neither one of them is perfect, so who's still to blame? This was a study, and no real patients were involved. No real people were harmed, so to speak. But I would imagine what you'd want to do is have a human in the loop in this situation. And so the human and the AI are working together. The human, physician, clinician, says, hey, I'm kind of going through this. And the AI says, well, did you think about maybe ordering this test or thinking about it this way? and together they work harmoniously. Right now, that is the way everything is done, if at all. I mean, typically we either have a physician coming up with a diagnosis by themselves in a traditional legacy way, or a physician that's augmented by clinical decision support tools. That's the two ways. In no situation, at least in the US, is the AI doing the diagnosis and treatment by itself without any supervision, because there's no AI that has a medical license. And so part of having the medical license is being the last person who signs off on the case and is responsible for the care. So we currently don't have a situation, and I personally don't feel comfortable ever having a situation where AI is going to do everything. So your question is important, and I like your question, but in the for this situation, there's not sort of the parallel where there's something that, what do you do when the answer is wrong? It's like, we're getting better than we were before, and we're always trying to improve. And the sequential diagnoses will continue, because this is just a point in care, right? And so if a patient comes back, you're like, hey, I thought you had a pulmonary embolism, and we treated you for this, and you still have shortness of breath. Actually, that was artifact, and you really have, you know, this viral pneumonia that's very subtle and is out there, or whatever it is, you know, the situation. And over time, you have a chance to refine your diagnosis and hopefully don't cause harm. So, I don't know, did that sort of answer your question a little bit? Yeah, perfect. Who's next?
In this example of multiple agents, how do you reconcile a certain weightedness of one aspect of a problem versus another? In other words, you've got five agents, say, on a problem, and you define what their roles are for each of the problems.
Sure.
They all have equal input. What is it? What is providing a judgment as to which of those elements has greater priority over others?
That's a good question. So there's a long and short answer to this. The short answer is it depends on how you want to design that system. And, you know, if you want to say that the persona that has the hypothesis, or the persona that's sort of challenging the tests, or the persona that's the you could have all these different personas, and you could weight which one has greater influence if you wanted to. That's not how they did this study, but you could do that. So this study was really just a proof of concept, and there was all these different personas, you know, like people at a round table, at a tumor board, that are coming up with ideas. But there was an overarching AI that was listening to all of these and saying, okay, I'm going to be the objective arbiter of this committee, and we're going to go in this direction. And so there's, just like in any meeting, you're going to have a leader in the meeting that says, okay, thank you for all of your input, and based on your input, I'm going to go in this direction. And depending on how you design that leader, or whoever that leader has intelligence about, whether in real life with people or the agents, it depends on how you program it and what the background is.
As a physician, one of my concerns is that when we see a patient face to face and we start talking to them, it's not just about medicine, right? We capture a lot of emotional cues, put things in context, culturally, and others. How do you foresee the relationship patient-physician changing over time with this adoption of these type of tools?
That's a fantastic question. I mean, all these questions are really awesome questions. And at a high level for all these questions, we're building the plane as we're flying it. So it's up to us, really, all of us, to figure out what's the best way to do these things. So to your question specifically, how is this going to impact the patient-physician relationship? I think that's one part of your question. You think about the airline industry, maybe that's an analogy we could use. Most modern planes can fly themselves. They can land, they can take off, they can cruise by themselves. Most people, including me, would be uncomfortable getting into an airplane without a pilot. But I think in healthcare, it's more profound than that because there's a human interaction that people are looking for, me, myself included, someone you can talk to understand the nuances. And even more than that, what you touched on, I think is important too, is it's not just about the written word. It's not just the structured text, or in this case, structured and unstructured data. You have all these other cues. I mean, if you're working on the medicine ward, you can walk by a room and you'll smell something and you'll know that patient has a GI bleed or squamous cell carcinoma. You have other senses, or you just look into the room and you're like, we need to address that immediately because this person is going downhill quickly. And it would be very difficult, I think, to safely say that you could answer those types of subtle and profound questions with just text. However, we have sensors that can help with that from a technical perspective. We've got sensors for the environment. We've got sensors for the arms. We did a study with the DOD where we're looking at trying to predict COVID before it happened. And we had a couple of different wrist wearables. I thought for sure that it was going to be temperature that was going to be able to diagnose someone before they had symptoms. Because we have this prodrome where, you know, with COVID, for example, where you're sick, you got the disease, but you don't show symptoms yet. So you have this sort of this time period. And as it turned out, it was heart rate variability in that case. But there's different variables with sensors. But there's also other things that are emerging. So the voice is another biomarker. The tone, the timbre, the quality of the voice can predict depression, anxiety, neurologic diseases. And then the eye, you look into the eye and it's not just like you're no longer just diagnosing macular degeneration or diabetic retinopathy. You can kidney disease, renal disease, atherosclerotic disease, all through the eye. It's a window to the inside of it. So you have all these different additional biomarkers living in their own silos. And the idea of doing multimodal analyses is going to give us a more robust understanding about people. And when you do that, then you can even think about the next frontier is like digital twins. When you have all these different things coming together and you can create a digital representation of somebody based on all these different things, then you have a really profound understanding about a person from a raw clinical perspective. But even when you do that, you're not going to have that personal face-to-face interaction. Where this is going, I think it's happening super fast. To answer your another level of your question, it's happening super fast. And if we are not sort of part of this and patients want better care, I think they will find ways to get that care. So to some degree, we need to embrace it even though it's uncomfortable and things are changing quickly. It's changing the paradigm of how we usually deliver care.
Hey everybody, John here. Thanks for listening to another episode. If you enjoyed what you heard here today, please check us out on our website, www.americancollegeaim.org. Sign up today to become a member. And don't forget to save the dates, October 9th and October 10th, 2026, here in Chicago at McCormick Place Convention Center. We're having our second annual scientific session. Special shout out to everybody who joined us in 2025. You all made it amazing. Thanks so much for coming. We hope to see you all next year. Don't forget to sign up right away. www.americancollegeaim.org. We'll see you then. Bye, guys.